once again, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, listeners of all ages, as long as you're over 18, and welcome to Junk Dilemmas, an Irvine Welsh podcast. My name is Damien Kiley, and shortly you will also be hearing the voice of Mr. James King. This is part two on our discussion of the novel Glue. So if you haven't listened to part one, please scroll down slightly on your phones or listening devices and listen to part one from last week. But we are going to take off again here where we left off last week, still discussing the last section of the book. I'd just like to remind everyone once again that we're not affiliated with Irvine Welsh in any way. So our views are purely our own and nothing to do with him. And also a word of warning once again that we do discuss subjects of an adult and disturbing nature at times, and obviously use rude words as well. So, but thanks for listening, and let's get on with the second part of Glue.
But it's just so weird. It takes a real fucking strange turn where this is almost like a story on itself. You know, this would have made a great spin-off story, a follow-up story for Terry.
It was like a mad 36 hours, just fucking mayhem.
Yeah, like it goes on for a long time, and it's almost like he's not killing time, but it's like he's trying to make the last section long, just prolonging the fact that Carl's dad is dying and Carl has to make it back from Australia. As we say, Billy disappears totally, and we learn what the story is with Gally as well. So it's concentrating a lot on Terry here, and we get introduced to a lot of other characters. We get a lot more of Rab, who seems a pretty normal bloke, but all things come. I do like the section where he's his parents call around and his mother is upset because he won't wear this horrible replica Hibs jersey.
Hibs away kit.
This luminous green and yellow.
I remember it wasn't great, in fairness. Big baggy one as well.
And he's shamed into fucking wearing it for his mother. And this, again, reminded me of something from my youth where my mother knitted me an Aran jumper with a shamrock on the front. So it's like and it was horrible. It was a bit tight on me as well. But I remember having to wear that for one, possibly my first St. Patrick's Day out in Selbridge. And the slagans were not good around Wall Gardens. But we're introduced then to four new female characters, at least two. Anyway, they're in a group of four. They're just back from holidays. There's one called Lisa, who's pretty boisterous. She's on a train, you know, just kind of slagging lads and flirting, and has a bit of a potty mouth on her. She mentions she's playing with a vibrator at one stage on the train, and mentions that a clever lassie keeps a Durex in her handbag, but a cleverer one keeps a Duracell battery. But obviously the other more important character that we're introduced here is Charlene, and it's slowly revealed that Charlene is an abuse victim by her own father. Not nice reading, you know. A lot of it is almost, it's not graphically said, it's more implied, but you certainly get the idea. And actually, I have it down here, speaking of This Is England, it did remind me of a storyline in one of the later series of This Is England, which concentrated on the very same thing, and incestuous abuse, whatever you want to call it. So not a nice subject at all. And it leads, of course, to them meeting up with Terry and Rab in the club. Rab actually fancies Charlene and vice versa. I think Terry hooks up with Lisa, surprise, surprise. But there's a section then where they go to the pub and her father is there. And there's a good...
She lets him have it.
She does. There's a bit where she's debating whether to just stay quiet and just enjoy the evening in this fine establishment.
This fucking dump.
But then the page is actually split, very much like it would have been in, say, Acid House, where she's weighing up the pros and cons of outing him, and she does actually end up outing him, and one of his own drinking party bursts him down when he hears about this, which is quite good. But it just, there's just a never ending slew of stories here from this night out. Terry himself is in this black crushed velvet disco jacket, which, you know, would have been questionable even in the fucking early 80s. He's saying to himself that she's pretty skinny, but not just talking about Catherine, the anorexic pop star. She's pretty skinny, but nothing that a Ruby Murray and a few points wouldn't sort out.
And he does. He fills her full of fucking curry.
Does.
Then.
He's saying that, or she's saying that she feels like she's a slave to her record contract. Mm. And Terry goes, I know what you mean. I feel like a slave to Tony Blair. If I don't do 18 hours of work, he cuts off me dole. And he brings up the juice, the juice lorries to her as well.
Of course he does. He brings up the fucking everyone. She hasn't a, like, she can barely make out what he's saying in the fucking, in the accent. And then talking about juice lorries. And the best bit was when he was talking to her about disco in the beginning of disco in the late 70s, early 80s. Don't mind that New York show. Edinburgh's where it all started, in Leet. Just...
Yeah, you could be onto something, I don't know.
Maybe.
When you talk about, was it Northern Soul? I love the story about that as well, about how, you know, that kid obviously started from the old Motown records that stopped selling in America, so they just started shipping them out on fucking ships that ended up in Manchester. Literally, that's how Northern Soul started. But yeah, it carries on for a good bit. I love the bit where he's saying that he likes women that are into women's lib and that, so that's why he has her getting the Don Revy in. He likes a bird that puts her hand in her purse. He's into equality for Fanny. And he even brings her to a curry house, and they mentioned the curry house here.
They went for two curries.
Well, that's reminding me of Filth.
Yeah.
Going for stuffing themselves full of curry. But she actually does suddenly become hungry.
Yeah, she slashes into her.
Which I found a little bit insulting, possibly, to actual bulimics. I don't know. Like,
Jeez, Terry breaks down these barriers.
Yeah, is that all it takes for people to let their hair down? Like, it's a bit suspect. But in the midst of this, then we do get Carl getting word that his dad had a stroke, and he, you know, there's this mad rush to get to the airport. And we get a couple of paragraphs from his girlfriend Helena's point of view, and she remarks that he almost killed himself by taking too many drugs and wandering off into the desert. And that reminded me, I'm pretty sure that happens again in a future short story involving Carl and Terry in one of the short story collections a few years after this, called Reheated Cabbage.
Hmm.
There is a story called I Am Miami, so it's about Carl doing well for himself again, getting gigs clubbing in Miami, but does go off the rails a little bit. I think it involves an alligator as well, and that teacher, Mr. Black, that was mentioned earlier in the book. But we'll get to that in due course.
Indeed.
So just it carries on. Obviously, they have the party spilled back to Rab's house. They, you know,
all the way along there. Though, they all just hate you. Choose Terry. He just fucking, Rab absolutely detests him.
Yeah, but but he's kind of stuck with him for the night.
Yeah, but he's bullying him and everything.
Yeah, And that carries on into porno as well, actually. Rab is always kind of the voice of reason. And at this stage, all he wants to do is possibly head off quietly with Charlene, even though he knows what the story is with her from what happened in the pub. But it's funny, and there's a bit where they're back in the apartment and Terry is shagging their one Lisa, and he tries to enter her rectum, and she sticks a finger up his arse as he says, disturbing his Rockford files. Also, while this is all going on, your man Franklin, the manager of Catherine, is going around Leet, and there's a fucking hilarious beer where he goes into the wrong pub and meets none other than Begbie and Larry.
Two nice men to meet.
Well, I thought it was brilliant the way it looked. Begbie seemed very out of character here, where he's
the being voice of friendly
to your man, and Larry is the one getting upset, thinking that your man is being dismissive of him. Begbie calms down Larry, but all the while it was just a ruse to rob your man's wallet. And he learns later on, when he finally gets back to his apartment or to the hotel and is able to access his accounts, that the fucker's cleared out $2,000 from his accounts, which is good. Sorry, catching myself on my old wire here.
Sorry.
Actually, it mentioned as well, you know, there's just these small characters that are just mentioned from time to time. So when Terry and Rab and that are getting drugs later on in the night, it's from a guy called David Creed. Now, I don't think he's mentioned again. I don't believe so. But I just found it mad that they mentioned that he's got scars all over his face from a time where somebody stood on a milk crate with his head underneath, which isn't good. Hurt. That section...
Is there anything to Apollo?
I don't believe so. Mention that. That section, actually, that whole chapter is called The Bitterest Pill Is Mine to Take, which is obviously a song from The Jam. Thought I'd mention that. I'm sure our friend Mossy would appreciate that. But where are we? Oh, yeah. So there's another guy that was involved in their party for a while, Johnny Qatar.
Yeah.
Is it Qatar? Or is it? He has a fucking cleft palate or something.
No, he was named after it. What was it?
He calls himself Johnny Guitar.
Yeah, Johnny Guitar, yeah.
But there's a bit where he's... So they're all sitting there almost fantasizing about what they want to do with your one Catherine. And obviously Terry But your man Johnny reckoned that he could use her as a stepping stone to further his career. And he's fantasizing this whole gig where he's gigging with Elton John and George Michael. And they start hugging him on the stage. Yeah. I have to think about that one. I don't know if I want to be hugging those two lads in public.
Yeah, that was deadly though.
But the whole time you're just reminded of the fact that Terry is from the old guard, and you know, as you say, they start taking the piss out of him. There's another bit where they're in the apartment, and somebody says, "Put on Beck,"
yeah,
and he puts on "Hi Ho Silver" by Jeff Beck, and that's possibly the only point of these new characters, is to emphasise the fact that Terry's getting on in years and kind of embarrassing himself almost. Enjoying life, it has to be said, or he appears to be, but, you know, he's just on a downward spiral himself, just at a slower pace than Galley was. And I think, it's pretty much at that point that it is revealed by Carl that Galley is dead, that he died shortly after the crack, really, in Germany. So there's a couple of days where a couple of important things happened. There's, you know, Galley had another fight with your man, Paul Mont.
You went to kill him.
Yeah. And he
finally have it out. Yeah.
Ended up fucking up his voice box. He had to.
Got shot by a crossbow.
Yeah, and he ended up having to use one of those. Kane, my name is Kane. And then, literally the day after, they all meet up and are going for pints. But Galley just throws himself off a railway bridge. Is it a railway bridge or just a bridge or motorway bridge or something? Or,
something tall here. Yeah.
Yes, and I think I have it in a disturbing section. It's pretty. I don't know if we'll read it out, but yeah, it's pretty graphic. And just, you know, he's in bits, basically.
If you jump off a giant bridge and hit the ground, it's...
Well, it's descriptive of how fucked up his head is with the blood and that. And obviously, what struck me as well was the reaction of both Terry and Billy. You know, when you see Terry kind of break character from this jovial chap to, you know, being visibly upset, it's pretty striking. Yeah, so it's put down on his cert that it was death by misadventure.
Carl knows it was suicide.
Yeah, and plus it doesn't mention then on the death certificate that he was HIV positive, which obviously would have upset his mother. It's bad form. That night then, as Carl is still making his way home, that the night for Terry and co ends in the business bar, which is Billy's pub. He's still in charge there, but as I say, this is the first time he's been introduced in quite a few pages. The one thing I noticed here was Rab is still wearing that Hibs jersey that he hates. Like, he was already back in his house. He could have changed. And he must be stinking at this stage.
Can you imagine,
And yet he still nabbed Charlene.
It's someone from Texas, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's her. Maybe the same one, actually, yeah.
Probably was.
And it ends with Billy asking Terry to leave the bar, and they have a bit of a row.
Then bursting him,
Well, your man Franklin finally catches up with Catherine in there as well. So he gets involved in a row. So it all spills outside. They're all fighting with each other. Billy fucking clocks Terry one. And then El Post Alec is there. They've picked him up along the way. I think
some other old lad as well. Yeah.
They stopped off at his house for a while and then somehow dragged him into this. You can only imagine the face on Billy. With fucking Terry.
Just a real posh bar in the middle of fucking Edinburgh, yeah.
Terry, for the state of him coming in his jacket, Rab in this fucking luminous away jersey, and Post Alec just in general. But I fucking thought it was gas. Post Alec is trying to stick up for Terry with Billy. Yeah. Gets into a fighting stance, says, "All right, champ." And then just has a coffin fit. And brings up a load of phlegm. But there's a couple of sections like you get kind of Terry just talking to himself, just reminiscing on stuff after Galley's death, and he remembers turning up at the door to Galley's mother's house, and he got the blame for what happened because, you know, he was the schemey who was left behind. He was the one that never made anything of his life, so he obviously was the bad influence on Galley, not so much the successful Billy or Carl. And he does come to realise as well, Terry, that he's pretty much just like his old man at this point.
The exact same, yeah. And he was nearly, he used to blame his old man. He says, Asher, I can understand why you're doing it now.
Yeah, it's mad. He blames his old man, but yeah, he always kind of had him up on a pedestal as well. But he does mention here, I thought it was funny, at one section he says, the old cunt just wanted a decent ride, the sequel book, a hassle-free life, easy money, and a bit of respect, which is pretty much all he wants as well. But yeah, as you say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, but I suppose he's different at least from his dad, where he at least wants to try and make a go at things for himself. I don't know how successful he is now as the latter books go on. He certainly... He's not making too much of a go. Well, he does get into the film business in porno. We'll cover that on our next episode or future episode anyway. But he does start to have like intrusive thoughts about what his own son will turn out like. And he's there's a weird bit where he's envisioning his son, like Back to the Future 2 or something, where he's envisioning his son in the future won't be having proper rides. He'll be just riding by virtual reality. Oh, yeah, and of course, Catherine eventually does go back to her career. She does a gig at the Islington Showgrounds and she dedicates her encore to Terry and the lads. Well, he's disappointed that she didn't call him Juice Terry.
And then she goes back to some scabby old pub.
Yeah, they bring her back to some house, put the Gauntlet Pub in Bloomhouse for a karaoke competition, and her and Terry win it. They did their own version of Don't Go Breaking My Heart and then Islands in the Stream. And they even won a set of kitchenware, which I'm sure Terry was delighted with. Probably sold them straight away. But yeah, it's at this point that Terry vows to lose weight, cut his hair, and upgrade his wardrobe. And I think it's him as well. I don't know if it's him or Carl. It must be him. But he spots Renton on a train going from Glasgow to Edinburgh. So this doesn't really come out. It's just one of these small sections that... would have made you wonder, oh, what's the crack here? Because this is obviously after Trainspotting. What's Renton doing back?
Yeah. But
it is revealed in porno that, unlike the film Trainspotting 2, that Renton has been back and forth to Edinburgh a few times, obviously on the sly.
Yeah.
And he tries to kind of time it with Begbie being in prison. but a lot of times...
Which is often enough.
A lot of times he's just saying to himself, oh, you know, the last place they're going to look for me is back here. So he just slides in to see his parents or whatever, which I don't think that has as much of an effect as the big comeback that happens in Trainspotting 2. But once again, we'll get there. Yeah, and that long, long night finally ends with actually Rab and Terry having a row. And he goes over Charlene, but it's they're in a hotel room. Yeah, they've talked Catherine into...
Yeah.
Is it her hotel room in the Balmoral or another one again?
I think it's another one.
Because she fucked off away from your Aunt Franklin. But yeah, Rab and Terry get into a row. Terry's chasing them out of the room, onto the corridor, onto the staircase, and nearly fucking goes over the banisters. And his gut saves him. And he relies on Rab. Fuck it. Rab was contemplating letting him fall, but does actually save him then. But the row spills out into the street then, even after that. And Carl, who's actually finally back and struggling with his bags in the street, gets picked up by Billy in his car. They actually pass by Terry and Rob fighting
in the middle of the street. I'm fucking 11 in the morning.
Yeah, Carl just hasn't the energy to even point it out to Billy, just leaves it and they head off. And obviously he's heading off to see his dying father. And we get a small section with his dad. And I had mentioned before his dad's
rules. 10 rules of life.
10 rules of life. Do I have it? Anyway, I know the important one was don't, you know, stick up for your mates and don't grass on anyone, especially your mates and whatnot. But, you know, Carl is kind of trying to think if he's lived by these rules. Not so much, maybe. But, you know, he's back now and he's...
He lived by the spirit of them.
Indeed.
If not by the actual rule of them.
He mentions at one point that, you know, obviously... After he started coining it with his career, he was able to look after his parents and saved their home, took them on trips, even brought them to Graceland, which obviously would have been great for the Elvis fan father. He mentions that he brought his father on a trip to a club in Leeds after being to Old Trafford and gave him an E.
Which was interesting.
Indeed. Perhaps started bringing on his strokes. But I suppose once Terry... hears about Carl's dad, all the shite with the barrels goes out the window and he heads straight to the hospital as well. So Carl and Billy are waiting there and there's a couple of you know heart-wrenching moments where the father is in his last minutes of life, but it's somewhat spoiled by Terry spotting a red-headed nurse and having more intrusive thoughts about ginger pubic hairs. He has a weird moment where in his mind's eye he can see a piece of grey matter in his own skull with silky ginger curls coming out of it. Whatever the fuck that means. But I suppose the lads see a second chance for their friendship after Duncan, the father's death. And I think I have it in writing. There's a couple of sections after that, which we'll get to. But they have a long discussion then. Terry confesses that it was him that was with Galley the night that Polmont was hurt.
And he killed him.
Yeah.
Well, shot him with the crossbow.
But he wasn't there to back up his mate. He was there in case Polmont told Galley about Terry shagging Gale.
Yeah, yeah.
And possibly more, actually. Do you think that Terry is actually the real father of Gale's daughter and not Galley at all?
He could be the boy, possibly. Could be the father of many children, yeah.
They should have had it that child had corkscrewy hair.
Mm. But, yeah.
But yeah, Terry was the one who accidentally, possibly, shot Polmont with the crossbow.
It wasn't accidentally, he aimed for him.
Well, yeah, I know. Maybe didn't mean to. Well, yeah, okay.
Well, you're going to shoot someone with a crossbow, you mean to kill them.
Yeah, but it was more retaliation as to what, you know, he was defending Carl at that point, or Galley. But yeah, it wasn't an ideal situation for anyone, really.
No, Terry was a prick.
But they just mentioned then kind of the cause and effect of everything that's gone on. You know, obviously Terry's libido has caused problems over the years, has caused the other lads to try and overcompensate for their lack of sexual conquests. Billy is kind of feeling guilty about the fact that he was the one who introduced Galley to Doyle.
Yeah.
You know, they're feeling guilty about the fact that they were involved in the football swedging with the knives, and Billy also
feels things could have changed with a few moments in life.
Yes, exactly. Everything could have been different. But Galley himself obviously was the main man to obey Carl's dad's rules by not grassing on Polmont
in the first place.
But there's a small epilogue then where Carl is back in the recording studio. Of which Terry is a regular and an annoying visitor. But Carl does have a comeback single featuring none other than Catherine Joyner.
Yeah.
Legs on Sex was the name of the song. A bit of an Ibiza anthem, apparently. And there was a number one album as well. And we just leave it with Billy actually ringing Terry to make plans for Rab's stag do. Presumably that's for getting married to Charlene. But he hangs up on Terry just to annoy him at the end. But I think that Carl remarks that both him and Billy are secretly kind of glad of the annoyance of having Terry around again. So it's all very happy-go-lucky.
It's very strange for an urban Welsh book.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose we'll do a bit of favourite writing, shall we, James? Yeah, page 105. So this is when they're infiltrating the Rangers side of the stadium when they go to the football. There's fucking chaos with every cunt pointing the finger at every cunt else, and the cops have got Gentleman, Juice Terry and Frank Begbie. They get dragged down the terrace steps and there's cunts spitting on them and trying to put the boot into them as they go past. The Begbie brothers are snarling at them, trying to get free from the policemen to get at them. His Harrington's jacket is ripped at the arm. Gentleman shouting, IRA, and Terry's just laughing and blowing kisses to the Huns. More bottles and cans fly and their paggers are breaking out all over the place. One bottle goes towards George Best on the pitch, just falling short. He picks it up and makes out to drink from it. The Hibs crowd cheer and some of the Rangers fans are laughing and all. To talk about players winding up the crowd, but I reckon that Best, just by doing that, stopped a major riot. The atmosphere was pure poison before that. We're off, Billy, Carl and me, heading one way, and the rest are sloping off their own ways. Joe's away with Dozo and that Polmont boy. Polmont did fuck all, never flung a punch, just stood there in the space, looking all nervous when every other cunt was firing in. I was surprised that Terry wading in all keen, because the cunt never seems that bothered early on. But that's Terry, though. Anything for a laugh and a bit of sport. I thought that was pretty cool about George Best. page 136. So this is after Galli has been arrested. Yeah, so it's just a kind of tragic section where you know, the coppers are interrogating Galli. So the plain clothes boy starts again. I know your father, Andrew. Aye, he's done some silly things in his time, but he's not a bad man. He's never got involved in anything like this. There's no wickedness in him, and I don't think there is in you either. I saw the laddie that had his face slashed by that knife. It tore off the nerves on his face. He'd be paralysed down the side of it for life. I think there was wickedness in whoever did that. Think about what your dad would say and think. Think about your mother, son. What's she going to feel like? Once more, Andrew, did you give that knife to anybody that night? You never grass. The fly is still there. He's climbing again. Andrew, the hard cop, says, no. The boy with the wart looks at us and blows out some air. On your own head be it. I'm a mug. I'm going down, but there's nought I can do. You dinny shop nae cunt. But surely some cunts will tell them it was Polmont. They'll not let me do time. No Doyle and that. Not the rest of the boys. They'll tell Polmont. They'll get him put right. The fly zooms off the wall. I'm not going to be the man of the house any longer. There's no man in the house anymore. Fuck, what's me mam going to do now? Yeah, pretty tragic.
Very tragic. Should have just told the truth.
Do you want to read this one? It's a good description of a pub.
Yes.
You can see it from
yes,
there.
Yes, I do.
This is page 481.
Of the egg book. The fly's ointment seemed to her like a clearinghouse for lost souls. Lisa fancied that she could see the dramas of future despair in pre-production. The rapist chatting to his victim, the crook drinking easily with the guy who would eventually grass him up, the boisterous bosom buddies in the corner waiting for the alcohol to eventually overload and overheat the brain. When in rage or paranoia, one would be smashing fist or glass in the other's face long before closing time. The ugliest and the scariest thing of all, she thought, looking round at her own company, was that you couldn't sit back smugly and exclude yourself from the equation.
Indeed.
Heartfelt.
There's one here on page 490. All I could think of was my ma's place. Get a kip, shave and shower and wash off the external dust and grime, and then I'll see everybody. Maybe even catch up with the boys. Well, maybe yes and maybe no. I'm too fucked to feel anything about Scotland. Only being an hour away. I just want a bed. Lies. It was all lies. We kept away from each other because we reminded each other of our failures as mates. For all our big talk, our friend had died alone. It was all lies. I kept away from Terry and Billy. So that's obviously from Carl's point of view after Galli has died. Yeah, so page 539, they saw some young kids, they must have been about 10, playing football. Billy thought to when they used to do the same. They considered time, ripping the guts out of people, then setting them in stone and just slowly chipping away at them. The newly cut summer grass had that sweet and sour whiff. The machines seemed to tear up just as much dog shite, ripping open toilied over crusts. The kids were fighting with grass, stuffing it down each other's necks, just like they used to do, not even thinking about being smeared with canine shite. Oh, the joys of youth. One more page, 540. The scheme, the government employment scheme, the dole office, the factory, the jail, together they created the squalid stink of low expectation which could choke the life out of you if you let it. There was a time when Terry felt that he could keep it all at bay, when the weaponry in his social armour seemed substantial enough to just blow big, technicoloured holes in it all. That was when he was Juice Terry, wide out, fanny merchant, and he could skate above the ice as deftly as Torval and Dean. But struggle, survival, they were a young cunt's game. He knew some of them, the young team, and how they now held him in the same affectionate contempt in which he regarded post-Alec. So that's something that we mentioned earlier, which kind of drives it home. Yeah, less serious ones then, just about Terry himself, and there is a lot of them. Some of these are quite good. There's one where there's a description of his walking as like a rooster with piles.
And he did have piles.
Indeed. The Rockford files, as he called them himself. Oh yeah, page 240. This is Terry's view on what a lady thinks, likes a man to smell like. The motor smelled like a tart's bedroom. All aftershaves, mousses and gels. Sporty cunts are the biggest closet puffs under the sun. And I didn't really think that birds go for that tartiness in a man. They prefer the more natural body smells. Real birds, anyway. I suppose the kind that Beryl's into, but these prissy, wee, anorexic tarts with expensive clothes and sour faces that would split in two if they had a decent fucking length in them, they'd probably lap up this shite. No, so this is, I think this is Rab contemplating how Terry, you know, gets the women that he did. The thing is, you know it's all crap and all. That fat cunt. How the fuck he does it is beyond me. He's a good stone overweight. His clothes and hairstyle are 10. No, 15 years out of date. The fucking Rod Stewart of Acid House. So that's our favourite bits of writing.
Definitely. I was all over that.
Yes. You couldn't wait to start talking about them. Disturbing bits, James?
Had a fucking dog shite.
Dog shite?
The dog
bit. Sorry. Absolutely. Yeah. So we're not going to read sections from that. We already mentioned it. But yeah, horrible. And hopefully...
Pointless as well, I thought. I didn't think there was a need for
it. Not considering we've had it numerous times before.
And there was no... Like, they were robbing a fucking... Like... If you're robbing a load of cop or whatever, if you're going to kill the dog, you kill the dog.
Yeah.
You're not going to fucking torture and maim it. Like, it was just...
Well...
It was pointless.
I suppose it was just to emphasise what an evil cunt this Doyle is, but...
But sure, he wasn't in the book after that.
He wasn't in the book, really, it was more Palmont than him.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, outside Trainspotting, the two books that most people seem to talk about by Irvin Welsh is Marabou Stark Nightmares and Glue. And if I was not a big Trainspotting or... Irvin Welsh fan, and somebody recommended those two books, you're getting dog abuse in both of them. You'd be like, I'm not reading any more Irvin Welsh books.
No.
And the fact that that's so early in this book as well, that would
mean it was a bad start to the book.
Yeah,
I didn't think it started off well.
No,
but it got better as it went on.
Got better. Well, it had plenty of time to get better.
Yeah.
Other disturbing bits, as I say, Galley's death was a bit graphic and was obviously pretty upsetting, you know, both from the fact the state that he was in, but also the reaction of the other guys as well. And obviously the stuff with Charlene, again, we're not going to read any passages, but there's not that much in it. It's more implied, obviously, the abuse that she suffered at the hands of her own father.
Nothing to do with Scott and Charlene either.
No, definitely not. Scott was a much more upstanding citizen, played, of course, by Jason Donovan.
The one and only.
So that's our disturbing bits. It's time for everyone's favourite section, James. Connecting lines. Okay, connecting lines, and there is a fair few in this.
Oh, it's all over the place.
So Glue features the Trainspotting crew pretty frequently, and they're obviously in a lot of other Welsh shared universe as well. So. As you say, we got Spud. That's definitely a favourite section that I didn't write down writing-wise, but the stuff with Spud is fantastic. So he's there with a young protege as well when post-Alec and Terry are breaking into the house. So they pull into the driveway and they see another car there or something. It's some old banger.
Yeah, they've been casing out the joint for about a month. And next thing they go to rob it and there's this fucking pair of junkies in there.
Oh, so funny. And this young lad is actually shiting on the ground.
Yeah.
And as post-Alec points out, you're meant to do that at the end, not at the start.
He slips in the shit.
Oh, it's fantastic. Leaving a wee calling card, as they call it. Spud doesn't seem that bothered about robbing anything expensive either. Terry kind of makes sure that him and Alec get the good stuff. And Spud is left nearly with fucking tapes. And
a few DVDs. Yeah. Fucking hell.
But that was a very funny sight. It's always great to see the original Skag Boys back in a book, and especially Spud. When we read Acid House, I knew he was in that as well. I actually thought that this, the shiting thing in the house, was in Acid House, but obviously it's not. It's in this. So yeah, as you say, Juice Terry is mentioned, or is in Porno after this, Trainspotting 2. He's in a follow-up short story that we mentioned called I Am Miami with Carl Ensign Ewart. That's in the short story collection Reheated Cabbage. And I believe the teacher, Mr. Black, who was mentioned in this book, is also in that as well. He somehow finds his way over in Miami after his retirement, or in his retirement. And obviously we know Terry gets his own spin-off book years later called A Decent Ride. And I know Post Alec is in that, and possibly one or two others as well. But obviously here as well from Trainspotting, we got Sick Boy. Larry from the Acid House, we mentioned him. Katrina is mentioned as well. So the Doyle's family is mentioned here, and
in
is obviously
every
mentioned
book.
In pretty much every book. Dempsey, one of Lexo and Roy Strang's gang from Marabou Stark, is mentioned in the row that took place in the pub. And I think Ghosty Gorman is mentioned briefly
as well.
They don't name him, but they say that he's a cashy with white hair, so we know that's him. And obviously we mentioned that Lexo was mentioned as well. Keep your hand off that. I can hear it.
You can hear my hand?
Yes. You're rubbing off the the staunching. There's mention at one point of
staunching.
Yeah, it looks like a staunching a bit, doesn't it? There's mention of a Davy from West, who's a West Ham fan. I'm wondering, is that the Davy who was going out with your one with the flippers in ecstasy? We'll just say it is. Lisa, your one, Charlene's friend, the mouthy one, she mentions that she works in Scottish Spinsters, which is where Roy Strang worked. Obviously a rip off of Scottish Widows. Tyrone Power
was in a Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels.
No, I'm pretty sure he was in Skag Boys.
Snatch.
Snatch has nothing to do with our melt.
Tyrone. He was definitely in it.
It mentions that Carl went out with an Alison Lewis. I'm wondering, is that Alison from Trainspotting? I don't think her surname was ever given. Page 309, there's a mention to the Beast, the infamous Beast.
Oh, yeah, Beast.
From Filth.
Oh, I thought it was from Father Ted. That'll be the Beast.
And this is a bit of a stretch, but I'm going to mention it anyway. It mentions that in that youth club that they went to.
Club in Oak.
No. I wish. Atomic is playing by Blondie, which of course is from the Trainspotting soundtrack. But interestingly enough, it wasn't released as a single by the time they mentioned that this took place. This was in December 1979.
So maybe Juice Terry was right that disco and all sorts of music did start in Edinburgh.
Maybe so, yeah.
Not New York.
I think the album it was on, Eat to the Beat, was out since September 79, but not that song. So maybe that DJ was just being really cool and obscure. And
that's fine. Some seriously nerdy shit you're talking
about.
It
there. Really is, isn't it? Anyway, I think that's all of Connecting Lines, James. If we've missed any of our listeners, please write into us on any of our social media accounts.
Seven.
If you have any questions at all, thoughts, concerns, please let us know, and I'll be sure and get Jem to answer them.
I'll answer them, no problem.
And yeah, we're into overall thoughts. So, do you want to go first?
Sure, why not?
After you've taken a long swig of beverage.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good book. Started off bad, but got good.
Okay.
It's one of the more readable ones. It's not too much dialogue. It's more in people's heads, so it's proper English, as they say. But it's a good story. It's a story that... It's about friendship. It's about male friendship.
Yeah.
Growing up together. What happens? Some people excel, some people don't. Some tragedy. It was a good story.
Yeah, yeah. As we've mentioned, I think it's very similar to Trainspotting, but in a more generalised way.
Yeah.
Like, it's not dealing specifically with drug abuse, even though there's drug abuse in it. And obviously, Trainspotting was a lot more than just drug abuse as well. But it's just dealing with a lot of other themes, I think. As you mentioned, friendship, betrayal, peer pressure, strong peer pressure. The kind of gold standard, if you like, of doing one better than your mates and getting to brag about it. You know, he expands more on kind of themes that he mentioned in other novels in terms of the violence on the football terraces or in the streets. You know, we get depression, we get suicide. You get this overlining theme of family values and kind of the sins of the father following you in your own life. I don't think it's a book I tell anyone to read first if I was recommending Welch, because it's pretty full on in that regard. But it's a good follow-on book from, say, Trainspotting, If you wanted a book that goes more in depth into some of those themes, I think Juice Terry is a brilliant character. He's just as memorable as any of the Skag Boys from Trainspotting, and I think that's probably the main reason he crops up again in other books. But the other guys, not so much. I mean, Galley's tragic story is an important part of the book, and he is a good character, but obviously he's cut short. As we mentioned, the other two, not so much. But it's bloody long as well.
It is. I think your woman, the country singer, what's her name?
Catherine Joyner.
Yeah, she's nearly one of the main characters in it. She's in it more than fucking Billy Burke.
In the last third, she certainly is. And as we mentioned...
But the whole lot. But she's hardly mentioned it at all.
That could have easily been its own book or short story, as we say. And it seems to be filled with a lot of stuff like that. The German stuff
I thought she was good.
But it's almost like he threw all this into it to make it seem like it's over a longer period of time, which obviously he's trying to make the impression and give you the feel that this is a book that covers, well, at least 20 years.
Slightly more, yeah.
Well, it goes into the turn of the millennium from kind of the late 70s, so a little over 20 years. So he did, I think he tried to give it an epic feel, but obviously it's concentrating on essentially four main characters. It becomes more than that towards the end, but it's definitely a character driven novel, and I'm all about the story, to be honest with you, and in that sense it doesn't have a huge story, but then again neither did Trainspotting really.
It was a story, just life basically.
But the progressive overall story is weak at times because of this, but it's still good. I think it'd make a great TV series. You know, like you could make a three-parter on the three moments in time that it was based in. The late 70s, early 80s, the early 90s, and then the turn into 2000. I think that'd be great.
And then just Juice Terry on his juice box.
Absolutely.
The juice lorry. He wasn't even driving it. He was just hanging on to the back of it.
He's an integral part of it. The inspector or the ticket collector on the bus, as opposed to the driver. I think that's good enough. Marks out of 5.
Every time I ask this, what did I give other books?
You've given various... I can't remember what you gave. I mean, the highest, I think you weren't on Trainspotting, obviously. I gave that 5. I'm pretty sure I gave Marabou Stork 5 because I really liked the story. I don't know if I changed my mind on that now, but... Sure, I'll go first. I'm giving it 3.5. Purely because, as I say, it's got some great sections, great characters, or at least one really good character, but some great short stories comprised into a bigger novel. But overall, I just think it's lacking something. It's lacking
bollocks. Lacking a bit of bollocks.
It's definitely, it's just
a bit of direction.
It didn't flow as well as possibly other books do in a story. As I say, it just takes a complete 180 almost with the section with the pop star, and then kind of comes back to obviously the point of the book, the friendship and the glue, shall we say, that binds them all together. I still certainly enjoyed it, but 3.5 for me.
I'm torn between 3.75 and 4.
And two lovers,
yeah. It's a lot of Welsh's books, I find. There's long parts of it that I don't enjoy reading. Just the subject matter plus some of the fucking shite he goes on about just annoys me. This one I didn't find that, apart from the start, the bit with... I found the start bad, but after that it was good, it was interesting, so I should go on and give it 4.
4?
Oh. I didn't think the story was great, but...
Yeah.
It was an easy read. You enjoyed it.
Yeah, this could be... I don't know. This could be the first time you've given a higher score than me. Possibly.
I would say so.
But anyway, that's that. That is glue.
Boom.
Lovely stuff. I don't know what we're going to do next. We keep saying it, we're going to do creation stories, so maybe we definitely will do that next.
Whatever
that
is.
Send you another dodgy film link and you can watch it.
It's just a film, is it?
It's a film, yes.
I'm
not going to explain to you what it is again, because I know I've told you before.
It's about something, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah, but every time you explain it to me, it's at the end of the podcast and I'm pissed.
Yeah, oh, fair enough.
So
remind me to ring you tomorrow when you're sober and hungover, and I'll explain it to you. But we'll probably do that. But currently, James is reading
in the middle of a porno.
not his normal type of pornos, but the actual sequel to Trainspotting. So we'll definitely be doing that. We'll obviously be doing Trainspotting.
So far, no animal abuse in it. So I'm
no,
it's good.
Definitely
good
not. There's abuse, all right, but not of animals.
Yeah.
I was going to say the nice abuse, but there's no nice abuse.
Well, some people pay to get abused. Like,
I suppose.
You ever see them lads who get their bollocks kicked and stood on
yeah,
all that?
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah,
I'd call that abuse.
Yeah, it would depend on the kicky,
No, fucking Africa.
You would be the kicky, wouldn't it? The kicker
or the kicky?
Yeah, it would depend on the kicker or whether I consider something like that.
Well, in fairness, I wouldn't get any enjoyment out of either, like kicking anyone, someone in the bollocks or being stood in the bollocks. Done. Yeah, yeah,
definitely not.
Not in that sort of sexual way, anyway.
Anyway, on that note, anything else you'd like to discuss?
Did you get a new bed?
Yeah, I didn't. My daughter did.
All right.
That's just the packaging off it.
I was just wondering.
It's been in the kitchen for a while now. If you probably get rid of it.
Just fuck it out.
Have you seen the price of bins these days?
Just fuck it. There's a big green out the front. Just fuck it out there.
Just burn it.
No, just throw it out.
Here in the kitchen.
No, don't burn it in the kitchen.
No, I'll take it outside and burn it. Yeah.
Just fuck it over the wall. Back wall.
But other than that, I don't think we've anything more to discuss. Thanks again for listening. You know, if you're listening, sure, leave us an old review. People always say leave reviews on Apple Podcasts, but not everyone has an iPhone. I don't, so I don't expect a review on. But we have a Facebook page. Leave us a kind comment on there.
Or a shy comment, whatever you want.
Yeah. Retweet us, share us on Instagram, all that stuff. And as I say, buy this new book that comes out, because that looks great.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree with this new book.
By Glenn, Jay Glennie.
Glenn what? No.
Jay
Glennie. Glenn Danzig.
Glay Jenny of Coattail Publications.
Glay Jenny?
That's his name.
Stop. His name? Fuck off. Glade Jenny.
Jay Glennie.
Oh, sorry. Glade Jenny. Jay Kenny.
Buy that book.
By Jay Kenny.
Buy that book and stay tuned for our next episode.
How is he releasing it? It's not Welsh.
No. Nothing to do with him. I think he does. Lots of people contribute to it. All the stars, Irvin Welsh himself, lots of celebrities, the people that worked on the soundtrack. It sounds fantastic, honestly.
What's the book about?
It's about Trainspotting.
Is it Trainspotting or is it just...
No, it's not just about the film. The film, yeah.
All right. Well, that's, I thought it was just another rehash of the film.
No. Do you remember Annuals when you grew up?
Yeah.
You're a bit like one of them, but for grown-ups.
Like Shoot.
Yeah.
19...
Or Oink.
Oink. All right.
Or Viz. Anyway, I think it's time to head off. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the flip side.
I don't know what the fuck that means, but yeah, come on. Good luck.